that the Corps interpreted the scope so narrowly that it wasn't going to consider oil spills as a potential environmental impact. And we all know that it's not a matter of if a pipeline is going to spill oil, but when.
The Corps has said assessing the risk and impact of oil spills falls outside its authority and should be handled by a different federal body. If it issues the tunnel permit, the tribes will likely challenge the decision in court. For National Native News, I'm Izzy Ross.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 27, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Lexis Ponce, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. With another crisis brewing in Israeli politics, Israel renews attacks on Gaza. Trump's budget cuts make China happy, and Trump's deportations fight with the courts continues. First, with another crisis brewing in Israeli politics, Israel renews attacks on Gaza. It's all too predictable. When Netanyahu is up against a wall at home, he strikes Hamas. The prime minister has announced that he cannot trust the head of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency. Israel's cabinet approved his firing of Ronen Bar, the first time a Shin Bet head has been fired. Netanyahu said he was, quote, sure that this step is critical for the rehabilitation of the organization, for achieving all our war aims, and for preventing the next disaster. In other words, free the prime minister to resume the war against Hamas. Barr was reportedly prepared to step down once all the hostages were freed, but also did not want Shin Bet to take all the blame for the intelligence failure that led to the October 7 Hamas attack. Now Barr, backed by the opposition parties and others, says the firing is invalid and asks the High Court to intervene. The Attorney General's office had previously told the Prime Minister he would have to consult with it before dismissing Barr, to ensure there were no improper considerations. He does not appear to have done so. That doesn't faze the far right. The right must learn from President Trump to eradicate the deep state, said Itamar Ben-Gvir. Is this sounding familiar? What may lie behind all this maneuvering was revealed by opposition leader Yair Lapid. Netanyahu is firing Ronen Bar for only one reason, he said, the Qatargate investigation. Lapid declares, quote, for a year and a half, he saw no reason to fire him, but only when the investigation into Qatar's infiltration of Netanyahu's office and the funds transferred to his closest aides began did he suddenly feel an urgency to fire him immediately. The Shin Bet is looking into suspicions that top aides to the prime minister had improper ties to Qatar. Hiding corruption has been a long-running job for Netanyahu, and that is why continuing the war with Hamas is integral to his remaining in office and fending off legal problems. As Tom Friedman writes in the New York Times, Netanyahu has much in common with Putin. Both their careers depend on forever wars. Netanyahu knows that as long as the Gaza war continues, writes Friedman, there is not going to be a commission of inquiry into his responsibility for Israel suffering the worst death of Jews since the Holocaust in a surprise attack. So Netanyahu wants the war to go on. It's what keeps his cabinet together. Putin wants the war to go on. It's what reinforces his grip on power. And that is exactly what Netanyahu is doing, prolonging the war by renewing attacks on Gaza, again forcing Palestinians who had just returned to what's left of their homes to flee again. The Washington Post reports, quote, Israel began bombing Gaza again, breaking the fragile truce. The renewed Israeli attacks have killed more than 673 people since then, Gaza's health ministry said, more than a third of whom were children. An additional 233 people who were killed previously were added to the count of the dead after a committee tracking the missing confirmed their deaths. On March 25th, hundreds of Gazans protested against the war and called for an end to Hamas rule. Trump's budget cuts make China happy. If you're a Chinese analyst, you have plenty of reasons for concern about Trump's foreign policy, starting with the tariffs. But if that same analyst is tuned into the Trump-Musk budget cuts, there are reasons to be pretty happy. Among the many cuts are those to programs that compete with Chinese activities or investigate Chinese projects directed at the United States, such as the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon, which evaluates future threats, Radio Free Asia, the Cyber Safety Review Board, which investigates foreign penetration of U.S. agencies. The contradiction is glaring, one observer noted, between the administration's focus on the China threat and its undermining of key programs designed to reduce the threat. As one specialist in Australia said, quote, when we reveal human rights abuses or Chinese misinformation, it's another form of competition with China. And getting rid of it only creates a vacuum that Beijing is going to try to fill. And we are already seeing that happen. A former career CIA officer said the cuts were self-defeating, quote, we affirm Chinese beliefs that they are ascendant and that our decline is accelerating. Trump's deportations fight with the courts continues. The administration's deportation of alleged Venezuelan and Salvadoran gang members to El Salvador under the 18th Century Alien Enemies Act has run up against a very angry judge who has declared woefully insufficient the official explanation for why the plane carrying the men was not turned around at his order. In a sternly written order, the judge, James E. Boasberg, told the administration to explain to him why officials had not violated his instructions when they allowed two flights of immigrants to continue on to El Salvador, even after he directed the planes to return to the U.S. Trump and minions have assailed the judge for being everything from Marxist to crazy. He should be impeached, said Trump. Trump has refused to turn over flight data using the state secrets privilege. The judge's restrictions on new deportations remains, but it seems fairly certain that the Supreme Court will hear this case. Trump asked whether he believed he had the authority to round up people and detain them without providing evidence against them to the courts, said he believed he did. Quote, well, that's what the law says and the country needs. Of course, that's not what the law says. Surely even Donald Trump has heard of due process. And due process is what's keeping several international students who supported Palestinian rights from being deported without a hearing. While the court fight goes on, Trump is barreling ahead with the removal of immigrants. The administration will revoke the temporary legal status of 530,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans in the U.S. The order will be effective April 24th. It cuts short a two-year parole granted to the migrants under former President Biden that allowed them to enter the country by air if they had U.S. sponsors. Unless these immigrants have other legal protection, they will be subject to deportation. In other news, Russia and Ukraine expand the ceasefire. The two countries agreed to, quote, ensure safe navigation, eliminate the use of force, and prevent the use of commercial vessels for military purposes in the Black Sea. It did not specify when the limited ceasefire would go into effect. The U.S. also separately agreed with Russia to help it gain access to the world markets to export fertilizer and other agricultural products, and with Ukraine to facilitate the exchange of prisoners of war, civilian detainees, and kidnapped children. Let's see which of these separate agreements is actually implemented. And meantime, Russia continues to bomb Ukraine. Huge anti-government demonstrations in Serbia. It hasn't made the front pages here, but in Serbia, an estimated 325,000 people demonstrated in Belgrade following the death of 15 people in the collapse of a railway station. The demonstrations have been going on since November as people's anger at government corruption heightens. Their theme? They want a government that works. Students have been a leading force in the protests, which so far have forced the resignation of the prime minister and the transportation minister. But President Aleksandar Vučić refuses to step down. Do you think this might not be a good time for a Trump family member to drop into Belgrade for a business visit? Well, the demonstrations didn't stop Donald Trump Jr. from dropping by to promote a Trump hotel in Belgrade, the first in Europe. Never let politics interfere with business. Next, the U.S. resumes contacts with the Taliban. A U.S. citizen was released by the Taliban after 2.5 years in captivity. The Trump administration revealed that it has sent an envoy to Afghanistan for talks, the first such contact since the Taliban takeover in 2021. A Taliban spokesman said the talks covered bilateral relations, the exchange of prisoners, and consular access to Afghans in the U.S. Most observers caution that any resumption of normal ties with Afghanistan is far away. A briefing of Elon Musk on war plans with China is canceled. In what would have been an astonishing event, a planned briefing at the Pentagon for Elon Musk on top-secret U.S. plans in case of war with China was canceled after the New York Times reported it. Instead, Musk got a private briefing from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The idea that an unelected, unofficial U.S. official with billions of dollars in Pentagon contracts and major investments in China would be briefed on some of the most highly secret U.S. war plans is truly beyond imagination. But this is the Trump era. I can imagine what Musk might take away from such a briefing, information that would be useful to his businesses, and/or information that the Chinese would find useful. Trump himself pivoted on the canceled meeting, saying the Times report was a fake and admitting that Musk might be a security risk. Elon has businesses in China, he said, suggesting, quote, he would be susceptible, perhaps, to that. You don't say. Trump's territorial ambitions are the agenda in Canada and Greenland. Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has called elections for April 18th. Trump isn't on the ballot, but his tariff and statehood threats are. He'll face off with Pierre Poilievre, the more conservative candidate, but one equally concerned about Trump. Canadians will have to decide which candidate can best confront Trump and protect Canadian interests. Said Carney, quote, "We are facing the most significant crisis of our lifetimes because of President Trump's unjustified trade actions and threats to our sovereignty. Our response must be to build a strong economy and a more secure Canada." Trump claims that Canada isn't a real country. He might have added, just as Putin claims Ukraine isn't a real country. He wants to break us so America can own us. We will not let that happen, unquote. Poilievre also says Canada must stand up to Trump, but that requires different policies, such as lower taxes, secure borders, and more jobs. The polls, which before Trump's threats showed the Conservatives winning in a landslide, now show a very tight race. Trump continues to babble about annexing, his word, Greenland. I think it will happen, he said again this time last week, with the NATO Secretary General at his side. Then Usha Vance, the wife of J.D. Vance, and National Security Advisor Michael Waltz decided to pay an uninvited visit to the island. J.D. Vance then said he would go too. A Greenland official called the move aggressive. As the Arctic region becomes more navigable, some American planners think Greenland's value in minerals will increase exponentially. Possibly, the Pentagon has its sights on expanding Greenland's U.S. base to accommodate the Golden Dome missile defense. Right now, the U.S. military presence is about 200 at the Patufik Space Base, which is somewhat in disrepair. J.D. Vance shocked Danes when he suggested that Denmark was, quote, not being a good ally. He evidently forgot that Danish troops fought with the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the Danish government is promising to invest around $2 billion in Greenland's defense, including at a former U.S. airbase. The question is how much the Danes will have to do to satisfy Trump. U.S. intelligence reports on Xi Jinping's wealth. Back in 2014, journalists working in China reported for the first time on the extraordinary wealth of Xi's family. Now, U.S. intelligence has issued a long-awaited report entitled Wealth and Corrupt Activities of the Leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. It says that corruption is endemic in a system where political power is so centralized. The report highlighted that from 2012 through 2022, almost 5 million people within the PRC government and the Chinese Communist Party were investigated and found 4.7 million officials guilty. Xi and family have enormous wealth, estimated at, quote, over $1 billion in business investments and real estate. Most likely, Xi has someone manage these funds for him. The report does not directly link Xi or family members to specific investments, but it suggests that he, as well as all other high party and government officials, are well positioned to take advantage of privileged information concerning the economy. Finally, how to fuel a humanitarian disaster. Turkish arms in Sudan. It's hardly a revelation to say that civil wars only get bloodier when outside parties provide weapons in hopes of making immense profits. On occasion, the evidence for this becomes available, showing how an arms merchant can have overwhelming influence over the course of a war. Such is the case with Turkey's leading arms dealer, Baykar, which, from a Washington Post investigation, has supplied the Sudanese army and its opposition, the Rapid Support Forces, with the means of destruction. Drones top the list of weapon shipments. The Post was able to obtain a huge cache of documents that, quote, reveals in startling new detail how a well-connected Turkish defense firm covertly fueled Sudan's devastating civil war, which has dragged on for 22 months and created what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. It also shows how Turkey's defense industry has built relationships on both sides of the conflict, unquote. All this is happening despite United Nations sanctions on arms shipments to Sudan. By the way, the arms firm Baykar is owned by Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan's son-in-law. The Turkish embassy in Washington says Turkey has, quote, refrained from providing any military support to the parties. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gartov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Tish Odell, the Consulting Director at the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We're here to discuss her organization's work on laws supporting the rights of nature and a bill on that topic that is making its way through the New York State Legislature. Welcome to the show, Tish.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for coming on to talk with us. So the New York Assembly is considering a bill that's called the Great Lakes and State Waters Bill of Rights. That's in their current session, which your organization has helped to write. So get us up to speed. What is this bill all about?
Well, actually, this is the latest version of the bill. It was introduced 2 years ago as just the Great Lakes Bill of Rights, so it only focused on the Great Lakes. And the legislator who introduced it, Patrick Burke, it's an interesting story because it goes all the way back to 2019 when people in Toledo, we worked with them to pass by the people, a vote of the people, the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. And Patrick Burke is in New York, but he's in Buffalo, which is also on Lake Erie. And he happened to see, you know, the media attention. The Lake Erie Bill of Rights got a lot of media attention. And he saw that, and he took a version from it, pulled it offline, and kind of, you know, crafted it, you know, just changed it to New York and had introduced that, which we didn't know about. So what happened is the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, if you don't know the story, it was challenged within 12 hours of the people passing it in a vote by, you know, on a ballot measure. And it took a year, but it was overturned by a federal judge in 2020. And Patrick Burke contacted us after that, and he said, you know what, I need you to help me draft a Great Lakes Bill of Rights now, because just Lake Erie isn't enough. All the Great Lakes are interconnected. And I kind of chuckled and I said, well, did you hear that the Lake Erie Bill of Rights was overturned by the federal judge? And he goes, yeah, I know that, but we need to keep pursuing this. I mean, this is important. And now I realize that, you know, one lake isn't enough. And so that's kind of the backstory. So and this isn't normally how our work unfolds. We usually get calls from a community group or some concerned residents saying that, you know, their harm is coming to their community, whether it's fracking or a, you know, logging project or whatever, and saying, can you help us? So this was unusual for us to have a state legislator contact us to help draft a bill. So we did it. And we got criticism from some, you know, people in New York because, well, it should include this or it should have this in it. And so that's why we worked for 2 years then with community members to get their input, both indigenous, non-indigenous, people who lived along the Great Lakes. And so this version that's been introduced now is that version that has input from the community.
If it does pass the New York legislature, how would it change the legal landscape around these bodies of water?
Well, I mean, I think what's important, people need to they don't have an understanding of how the law currently works. And, you know, I work for a public interest law firm. And so people think, well, you just go to court and, you know, that's how this works. And we have the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Water Act. And so we already have things that should be working. And I kind of, you know, chuckle because I think, well, okay, we have 50 plus years now of experience with those. And how is that working? Are the waters being protected? Because the latest on, I think, the EPA's website directly even suggests that over 45% of the rivers, lakes, and streams in this country are too polluted to swim in, to fish in, or to drink from. So I would say they're not working. And so we, you know, did the analysis and other people working on rights of nature and said, okay, what is the problem here? Why aren't those laws protecting the water? What do we need to do differently? And part of the problem is the bodies of water themselves and the people in the communities that depend on those bodies of water have no voice. They're actually invisible under the law, especially when a project is proposed that's coming and the people know this is going to harm their community and the waters of that community. You can't get into court to stop it in any way. And people say to me, well, but we have public hearing. And I'm like, yeah, you have a public hearing, and that's part of the process and the checklist on the application for the permit that the corporation that's doing the project or the government that's doing the project, that they have to complete. That's a checklist item that says, did you hold a public hearing? And so they do, and people go and they tell all their, you know, reasons why it shouldn't happen, whatever the project is. And then they go home and they feel good like they did their part. But what they don't realize is they probably threw those in the trash can when you walked out the door and they shut off the lights. I mean, there's nothing requiring in the system, the legal system and the government system, for them to do anything with those comments. So that's why the projects go in, even though you'll read, like, you know, articles, well, 99% of the comments voiced at the hearing were against the project. And then you read the next day, you know, well, the permit was issued. So that's, again, you have to have an understanding of how our system currently works to understand how rights of nature in this New York bill could change it. So the way the law, if it was passed, would work, because if you read the language in it, it recognizes the rights of the waters of New York to exist, flourish, and thrive. And you have to have the rights recognized before you could get into court to say those rights are being violated. So we can think of it in terms of humans, right? So like in human movements before, for rights expansions, like a woman before she was recognized as having any rights in this country couldn't go to court and say, wait a minute, my husband's violating my rights, or this business is, you know, because they're not recognized. So, you know, if you think of it in those terms, right now nature and the waters of has no rights recognized. So you can't try to stop things for violating nature's rights.
I'm curious, can you tell me a little bit about the history of how the Great Lakes and other New York rivers have been polluted or impacted in these ways, such that establishing rights of nature for them is so important?
Yeah, and I know, because I don't know how much other people in the country, you know, like, know about the Great Lakes, but it is, I mean, the largest freshwater source of water in the world, and it's the Five Lakes, and they've been under tremendous threat for decades and decades. And actually, I'm located actually in Cleveland, Ohio, and it's interesting because Cleveland, if you've ever heard of the Cuyahoga River and it burning back in the 60s and 70s, that's what actually was part of the catalyst for the current, you know, the environmental movement that did the Clean Water Act and things like that, and the Environmental Protection Agency being formed. So it's kind of interesting, and it's because we were polluting during the whole Industrial Revolution period up through that time with industry so much of the waters of the Great Lakes regions and bioregions and watersheds. And so, you know, it's Detroit, the auto manufacturing and the steel manufacturing and all that. And so they've been under threat for a long time. And so we thought then we would clean some of these things up with those laws that were passed. And we actually did for a period. But the problem is people kind of thought, well, okay, the problem's fixed. The river's not catching on fire, which is a very low standard. and they weren't paying that much attention because they thought these agencies were taking care of the waters. Well, today what we find is between industrial agriculture, which is around the Great Lakes all over, we have huge algae blooms because of the animal, I call them factories, animal factories, so the big factory farms, the big monocultures, so they spray tons of herbicides and glyphosate on those. That's causing the algae blooms. We have a ton of, you know, people hear about the plastic problem in the oceans, but the Great Lakes have a huge plastic problem as well. It's like 22 million pounds of plastic a year are dumped into the Great Lakes. We also have a lot of nuclear power plants that are along the Great Lakes. Several of them have been shut down, but now with the AI and the data centers that all these big tech companies want, Microsoft is actually talking about reopening Three Mile Island, which was shut down because of an accident in the 70s. And so there's talk of other of these nuclear power plants that are very old. And they're, you know, they're not in good shape. And so even with the Fukushimas and the Chernobyls of the world that we've heard about, you know, they're still talking about this. It's total, like, I think, insanity. There's also an industrial wind is being proposed for the Great Lakes. Well, that has never been done in fresh water before. We have lots of industrial wind farms on land, but and, you know, and there's issues with vibrations and them leaking and, you know, all kinds of issues. But putting them in the Great Lakes, should we or shouldn't we? And, you know, so that's a key, too, with this law on rights of nature. The way rights of nature laws work in other countries like Ecuador, which we also helped them draft some of that language in their constitution, they now are having court cases come out of Ecuador that are ruling, and the judges are ruling in favor of nature and using the rights of nature language. So the way it works is a project is proposed, say it's a mining project, and the people there are like, wait a minute, we think this is going to harm our environment here and whatever the watershed or whatever it is, and they go to court. Well, then they go to court and say, provide all their evidence. Now the corporation who's doing the project has to also prove to the court why what their project is won't harm the environment, which here we don't have that. That's what I'm saying. You can't do that beforehand. You have to wait until the project goes in, the harm occurs, and then we have to try to find, you know, lawyers and pay all this money to try to get into court to prove that and then feel that money can somehow fix the problem.
Well, laws on the rights of nature have had a foothold here in Oregon as well, where I'm speaking to you from, with Lincoln County passing an aerial pesticide ban in 2017, though that has since been struck down by courts because of the extensive rights that timber companies have in Oregon state law to spray pesticides. Are there lessons to take from that saga? I want to kind of connect that to what we've seen closer to home here.
Oh, yeah. And that CELDEF worked with that group very closely. We were the law firm that, you know, helped them, assisted them along the way. So, yeah, it's very similar to what happened in Ohio. Like I said, I'm in Ohio, also passed a lot of rights of nature laws, and what we saw were challenges. And that's because the status quo system, and that just highlights and shows what the problem is with our current system. Like, you have to just accept that it's legal, and it's because it's permitted by the state and the government to spray aerial pesticides all over you and your community and your ecosystem of what you're a part of. and there's nothing you can do to stop it. So you understand it better than most communities across the United States who haven't experienced that firsthand. And that's what we're saying. This is a systemic problem that needs to change. And that's why Rights of Nature could change that. Because if you, as that community in Lane County, were legally allowed to stand up and say, we're part of this ecosystem, this forest ecosystem, and you're harming us as well as, you know, the natural environment that we are a part of. So that's the shift that we're trying to make. But what we realized is a lot, it's actually a cultural problem as well as a legal problem. And I always pose the question to people, does the law change culture or does culture change the law? And so, you know, what we've come to realize with groups like Lane County and Toledo, Ohio, and Columbus, Ohio, and Youngstown, and all the ones throughout the United States that we've worked with, it's a cultural problem too, because our legal system separates nature from humans, but so does our culture. You know, we believe that humans are above nature, that we're separate from it, we're here to manage it. It's a resource for us to just use and exploit for our benefit only. And, you know, not saying and putting blame on it, that's just the culture we've all been born into. And so there's a bigger cultural shift that I think has to happen where people really connect, including the judges and the lawyers and the CEOs of those companies, because that's what I kind of, you know, think about a lot of times, like even with the Great Lakes and what's going on with you guys out there, they have to live there too. They don't see themselves as part of the ecosystem either. And why would you poison? So every permit that the government hands out to a corporation to do some harm to the natural environment, they're actually legalizing and permitting the harm to the humans in that environment as well. But we don't talk about it that way. We don't see it that way. And so there's this also shift in cultural thinking that has to happen, I think, to help the laws change. You know, because I always say, what are the laws? The laws are, should represent the values of the people in that community or where we live. And right now, I think what we have is just laws representing the values of industry and the corporate side of things.